21st, 2020 marks 100 years since American women won the right to vote in federal elections. Like so many episodes in history, the real story involves advocacy and agitation for decades before the final showdown between suffragists and those who wanted to continue denying women the vote. Wisconsin as a state and Wisconsin women and men played a big role in the ultimate victory of the women's suffrage movement, and our next guest is here to tell us about it. Genevieve McBride is Professor Emerita of History at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and the author or editor of several books, including the anthology titled Women's Wisconsin, From Native Matriarchies to the New Millennium, which covers 400 years of Wisconsin history. She's also a former journalist. Jen, great to have you back on Central Time.
Hi, good to hear from you too.
Well, Wisconsin achieved statehood in May of 1848, and just a couple months later, there was a significant event in the U.S. suffrage movement. Tell us what happened in Seneca Falls, New York.
Oh, I so wish I could have been there this August 26th. We were planning such celebrations, but we went virtual. In 1848 in Seneca Falls in upstate New York, beautiful area called the Finger Lakes area. I've been there to see the National Women's Monument there on the site of the meeting. The first women's rights convention in the world was held there, called by Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who lived in Seneca Falls, and Lucretia Coffin Mott and a couple other women up there who had been dissed by men at a worldwide abolition convention in London and not allowed to speak, and that woke them up to say we must get our rights to be able to speak. And they asked for much more. Elizabeth Cady Stanton drafted a document called the Declaration of Sentiments at Seneca Falls, sentiments meaning our thoughts. And it was actually quite a list of demands that women needed to be equal in this country, and if you look at the list, it's online. We still don't have all those rights they demanded.
And it's interesting because you just mentioned abolition as a very large concern and point of activism at that point. And in fact, the Civil War was just, you know, a little over a decade away. Mm-hmm. How did the suffrage movement fare during the Civil War?
It was interesting. The women stepped back, devoted themselves to the war effort around the country, and very much so in Wisconsin. We can talk about that. But they stepped back from the suffrage movement, which had been working throughout the 1850s, holding more conventions around the eastern part of the country. But men in the reform movement, abolition and more, said, we will work for universal suffrage. If you will work for us in the Civil War, we will work for universal suffrage, which was the term for voting rights for all women and all men. And that did not turn out to be true after the war. The men reneged on their promise.
And there was a big overlap in people who were very staunch abolitionists and those who were huge advocates for women's suffrage. So it's not surprising.
There was an overlap among women and some men. But the temperance movement, which also dates back to the start of this country, also brought many women into the women's movement, like Susan B. Anthony, who had joined it in the 1850s.
So what did the suffrage movement look like after the Civil War ended, when it became clear that the universal suffrage promise or potential was not going to be fulfilled?
Yeah, it was heartbreaking to the women. There was an organization called the American Equal Rights Association, which met in 1866 in New York City. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was in charge. The men were fine with that, but then they refused to work with her when she reminded them that the cause was universal suffrage. And a reformer named Phillips, Wendell Phillips, said, "This is the Negro's hour," which he really meant this is African-American men's hour. The majority of African-Americans were not his concern to African-American women. And so they said, we are going to push forward with constitutional amendments for the rights of African American men. Now, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution was written by Abraham Lincoln as the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, and that became part of the Constitution after the war. But from this gathering, the reformist men went forward with what became the 14th and 15th Amendments, and those are the first time you will see gender in our Constitution. People say, all men are created equal. No, that's in the Declaration of Independence. The Constitution was gender-free until the 14th and 15th Amendments, which specified that black men would have citizenship and black men would have voting rights, the franchise. And those became part of the Constitution in the late 1860s. And so Katie Stanton and Anthony went forward with founding. They said, we're going to have to do this on our own. And they founded the National Woman Suffrage Association, for women to work for their voting rights, since men would not do so. There were a few men who were sympathetic, so some others organized a group of men and women who started the American Woman Suffrage Association. Those two would merge finally in the 1890s. Their children would merge them and unify the movement, because it did become, you know, evident that you simply had to work with men and get the support of men, because they were going to be the ones to, they were the ones with the vote, so they were going to have to be the ones to vote to expand it to include women.
We're talking with Genevieve McBride right now. She's Professor Emerita of History at UW-Milwaukee. She is the editor of the anthology titled Women's Wisconsin, From Native Matriarchies to the New Millennium. And Jen, 1869 is a significant year in Wisconsin suffrage history. Can you tell us a bit about the first statewide women's suffrage convention here?
Actually, that was there'd been one some people consider a little bit earlier, but this was the major one. In planning to found their National Woman Suffrage Association, Katie Stanton and Anthony went on tour of the West, as they called it. That's us. We were the West. And I actually came to Milwaukee in 1869 at the invitation of several prominent women in Milwaukee. We actually had women in the professions here, the first woman physician, the first woman studying law, the first woman newspaper publisher, briefly, till men shut down her paper here. And they invited Katie Stanton and Anthony here, and they held the first, what they call the first state suffrage convention, in Milwaukee City Hall. And I found wonderful accounts of it from participants later. One young boy at the time later wrote, he became a newspaper editor later, and wrote that as a lad he had strayed into City Hall and saw the convention where there was not a seat to be had, as they all were taken by the ladies. It was a standing room only crowd, and it was quite momentous. So they founded our state association, the Wisconsin Woman Suffrage Association, in 1869, and it endured under that name till 1920, and it actually endures today. In 1920, its name was changed to the Wisconsin League of Women Voters.
And that Wisconsin Women's Suffrage Association that was founded coming out of that convention, the first president and one of the founders was Dr. Laura Ross Walcott. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Oh, a fascinating woman. Yes, she was the first woman physician in this state. She's actually, I've heard her referred to as only the third woman physician in this country. She had grown up out east, a descendant of one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and she wanted to study medicine and was not allowed to do so. She finally was allowed to do what today we call some independent studies, to get through some college courses at Harvard, because the men wouldn't have her in the same room with them. She then went to, finally women had started women's medical schools, so she went to one of those, became the only the third woman to become a physician, came to Milwaukee to start a practice serving women and children. Women's health was not well served by men at the time, they did physical exams with women fully clothed, for example. And that was not going to uncover some diseases and conditions. Laura Ross, as she was then, had been here for 10 years by that time. And the men of the Milwaukee Medical Society, the only one in the state then, would not allow her membership. She solved that later in the year 1869. She married the president of the Milwaukee Medical Society, and who had actually been one of our surgeons general in the Civil War, and he got her admitted to the Milwaukee Medical Society just fine then. So.
We're talking with historian Genevieve McBride about the role that Wisconsin and Wisconsinites played in the women's suffrage movement. She's the author or editor of several books, including the anthology titled Women's Wisconsin. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the suffrage movement and events and characters here in Wisconsin? Do you know of any suffragists in your own family or who are prominent in your community? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with historian Jen McBride about the role that Wisconsin and Wisconsinites played in the women's suffrage movement. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What were you taught in school about the suffrage movement? Is it a topic that you've looked into on your own? What questions or comments do you have about that struggle? And does it surprise you that African-American males were given the right to vote before any women? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Well, Jen, there was finally an amendment for women's suffrage introduced in Congress, I believe in 1878. What happened with that first effort?
Well, yes, that is the part of the Constitution written by a woman. It was called the Susan B. Anthony Amendment for its author till it finally got a number long later. She wrote it and introduced it actually at our centennial celebration in Philadelphia in 1876. And then a nephew of hers was in Congress. And he actually submitted it to Congress, as you said, 2 years later. And it somehow just languished there for almost half a century. Apparently, none of the men in Congress could figure a way to get it out of committee and onto the calendar.
Amazing. And there were other attempts, also failures. What tactics did the suffragists adopt after those defeats?
Well, it was interesting. There's wonderful readings about this, but the difference between 19th century and 20th century suffrage movement and really the difference in American politics. In the 19th century, women argued the justice of their cause. It simply was a principle that should be upheld. Nothing in the Constitution, you know, barred women from voting, and it just, women actually in New Jersey had actually voted at the start and then had it taken away. And so their hope was, we'll go through the courts, and the courts will interpret the Constitution correctly and say, you know, everybody should vote. Well, then some court cases came. Susan B. Anthony and some others tried to vote, were arrested, refused. So it became clear that the courts were not going to be a good resort. So they were going to have to partake in politics. And they did it in a very high-minded way. Went out and made speeches, although women were not supposed to be speaking in public, but they broke down those barriers and took a lot of torment for it. And you know, wrote initialed editorials to newspapers, because women wouldn't sign their names then in the paper. Well, that didn't get them very far at all. It's interesting, in the 20th century, early 20th century, you see women starting to adopt more modern-day tactics of politics today. Politics had changed for men in the 19th century that way, and women took it up. So they started to do things like parades and street corner speeches and, you know, really get out there in public and pushing the cause, wearing costumes and marching with banners. And it was much more modern in terms of making it event-oriented. And we know that event-oriented news is what works. Newspapers and later on other media are not much for talking about principles and ideas. They want to talk about events. So you have to create events to create awareness of the cause as a very first step in public opinion campaigns. And that picked up steam then.
Let's go to the phones. And Ron in central Wisconsin is there. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Yes, I'm going to put in a plug for the patrons of animal husbandry, better known as the Grange. That was started right after the Civil War. And one of their rules, besides being anti-alcohol, is everybody was welcome and women could hold office and were elected to office and ran local Grange halls. And they went to the state and national conventions. And when I did my master's thesis and talked to a number of different Grange members, they spoke very highly in how excited it was that they could participate. And I'm just saying, hey, this is another organization that helped promote women to hold political office.
Wow, that's really interesting, Ron. And Jen, it sounded like that's something that you're familiar with.
Oh, yes. I love coming across some of the old Grange halls in Wisconsin. It was not as strong here as it was important, but not as strong here as it was in states to the west, the Plains states. The Grange was really strong, and that is where we saw some of the earliest suffrage successes. In the 1850s, women in Kansas won the right to vote in school elections. And when you look at who some of their leaders were, they were women who had gained public experience through working with the Grange and similar farmers' organizations. Farm women are very important throughout our history. You don't see much attention to it, but I remember at one point reading that not that long ago, a newspaper for farm women had the largest circulation in the country. They're still a very significant force. They are absolute equals on many farms and very significant. So, yes, there were organizations like that, not just abolition and temperance, but other reformist organizations like the Grange, which was reformist. It was looking for fairness for farmers against things like the new railroad prices and all. Bob La Follette built his career on that kind of cause. And that did give women in rural areas experience in speaking in public, coming forward, and realizing eventually that they were going to need the vote. A wonderful woman in Oshkosh, Jessie Jack Hooper, who later became our first president of our state League of Women Voters, she talked about starting in municipal civic work. What they called municipal housekeeping was a nice term women used to make it sound like they weren't really pushing men to act, but they wanted changes in the small towns, villages, and cities. And she said finally she realized she had to become active in suffrage work because she said they give us only a teaspoon, but only a steam shovel will do.
Thanks for that call, Ron. We are talking with historian Genevieve McBride about Wisconsin's role in the women's suffrage movement. And I don't want to leave people hanging, and I don't want to run out of time, Jen. 1919, let's fast forward there. The start of the year did not look like it would be promising for the suffrage movement. But then in June 1919, the 19th Amendment was finally passed and sent to states. And
yes,
Ada James was determined that Wisconsin would be the first state to ratify the 19th Amendment. Tell us that story.
Well, not just Ada James, but the president of the State Women's Suffrage Association, then Theodora Winton Yeomans, who had been in Washington, D.C. to see the suffrage bill finally come out of committee, come to the floor, get passed by the House in 1918, but the Senate wouldn't pick it up. So it had to start over in the new biennium. Finally, as you said, the Senate turned it down a couple of times. It finally passed June 4th, 1919, by just two votes. I think it was very close. And by that point, Yeomans had left Hooper back in charge of lobbying in D.C. and had raced back to here, and women drafted the necessary ratification document. There were three states with legislatures still in session then, Michigan, Illinois, and Wisconsin, where, once again, legislators hadn't gotten their work done in time, so they were still in session, and it was a real race then. Illinois actually didn't debate it, passed it first thing June 10th that morning. Wisconsin men still had to debate it and did other things that day that showed they weren't that fond of women's suffrage, but Illinois passed it first. But it turns out when their document got to Washington, it had incorrect language and was sent back. So Wisconsin's document, although passed an hour later, was handed off then to Ada James' father, David James, who had sponsored referenda bills for suffrage here. And the poor man was in Madison for a reunion of the Grand Old Army of the Republic, the Civil War veterans. So Ada James grabbed a traveling bag, as she called it, a carpet bag, stuffed it full of clothing for her father, sent him off to D.C. and by train and by car and on foot. He landed there, and Senator Lenroot of northern Wisconsin had his staff waiting for him. They rushed him to the Secretary of State's office where ratification documents go. He got it there, and then women back here waited till finally Theodora Yeomans could write in her Waukesha Freeman newspaper column, which was syndicated statewide, to which she informed women of what was going on throughout the last 10 years of the campaign. And she finally could announce she had the official notification from Washington, D.C., that Wisconsin's ratification of the 19th Amendment was recognized as the first in the nation. That meant so much to women here because we had become one of the worst states in the country. Women here still were behind in suffrage. Millions of women voted in many states by then. Even by 1916, women were voting in the presidential election, and they sent the first woman to Congress in 1916 from Montana.
And unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Great story. And Jen, thank you so much for joining us today. Jen McBride is Professor Emerita of History at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She was with us today to talk about Wisconsin's role in the victory for women's suffrage 100 years ago. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.